Raving under the cacophonous madness of these bleeding stars. We are the last bastion of sanity on the Pirate Voxwave, 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Coming to you live tonight from Misfit Alley.
And you know what, Gabo? From bare knuckle prize fights to hickory smoked barbecue underdog skewers, this place has it all. And it's the best place to keep off that Viz Gilda radar with all those damn Arbidi raids happening in the Upper Hive. Won't be surprised if we all end up conscripted.
I don't know. Kev may not be so upset about that one. Keep those arms, legs, and noodly appendages inside the ride at all times, as I will be your unhinged, wild-eyed, crazy driver tonight, Goblin King, making sure we are nowhere near a schedule and have forgotten the concept of time altogether. It's my navigator, the map-phobic maniac himself, Marky.
Sup?
And the voice of madness lost in this ever-echoing cacophony as we strive closer to reason, it's Kev.
Hey man, don't be knocking conscription. At least there's matching shoes.
There's a uniform.
At least they got girls, shoes.
Girls love a guy right? in a uniform,
and
right?
they match. And they match. That's the best part.
Most of the time.
Most of the time.
Yeah, sometimes they come with a foot in them still, right?
They might have two different people's names on them. But
different blood types inside
of them. Isn't
that
an entire like subplot of one of the Gaunt's Ghosts books, is they're just trying to find a matching pair of shoes for somebody?
I'm sure somebody got issued a wrong size boot at some point. It's either Gaunt's Ghosts or it's in Band of Brothers or Saving Private Ryan. Like somebody's going around specifically. Yeah. I do remember it somewhere from one of those stories. I mean, they're all basically the same kind of genre at this point.
You remember I think it was Book of Eli, where Denzel like takes those boots off and he has like saran wrap around his feet.
Yeah, and it's duct taped and everything.
Yeah, like can you imagine like the. What is like the trench foot you get from that? Because there's no airflow at all. Like,
I
when
know.
He took his boot off and he had that saran wrap like wrapped around his foot, I was like, dude, your foot must look like a freaking raisin, dude. Like, what are you doing?
It's probably disgusting. Like, I wore waterproof moto boots in the desert for Wasteland, and
yeah, like just normal hiking like cotton socks.
I was gross.
Yeah, it gets bad. Like, your feet, like, get wet when you're hiking. Yeah, they get wet.
You're into a lot of toe stuff today, that's all I'm saying.
I'm not. It was just one of those things that got brought up. You know, we were talking about
the toe jokes earlier, because I know they're on brand for Marky.
That's right. He's going to get mad if you keep taking his thunder, bro.
We were talking about boots. I was trying to keep it on the subject of boots.
We are talking about books.
Ooh, scusi.
Mi scusi. Welcome to episode 85 of the Horus Heresy Part 1. This is an extremely dense period of the Warhammer 40K universe's lore, which has probably had more books written about it than any other single period. We're going to strive more to cover the entire event rather than to get into too many of the little tiny details that exist all over the conflict. Also, by the nature of how lore is written, we will at times cover something that we've already talked about, or we will come back and expand on something that we mentioned just briefly in a past episode. In order to try and lay out the best cohesive explanation, this episode is going to focus a little bit like a recap of our last several series. That way, if you're jumping in now, it should all make sense moving forward. Just know if there is something that we bring up and you do want to know more about it, we have done at this point all of the series recaps, or not all the series recaps, but all the series that we've done in season 3 have been focused on 30K lore. So we've got episodes about the Emperor and the Primarchs. We've got episodes about the Unification Wars. We've got episodes about the Great Crusade. We've got a lot of detailed content already out about all the stuff we're going to briefly recap in the majority of this episode. But to start us off today, I have a quote.
Shall I? You're going to be doing a lot of talking today, I'm assuming, right?
You want to take this one? Are you going to give us a wizened old man voice?
Absolutely not. I only have one voice.
Come on, Marky, do a voice.
Do a voice.
I can't stick it. It's too long of a quote. Halfway through, it'll just turn into me. So I'm gonna be consistent.
When I did the Scottish accent for the Gotrick quote, in the middle of it, I completely lost the Scottish accent for like five words.
That'll be me. It started Scottish in the first sentence, and then after that, it was all downhill.
Yeah. It was all downhill. All right, end us with that quote, man.
Of all the conflicts that have beset this Imperium of Mankind, it is the rebellion of the War Master Horus, the Horus Heresy, which has left the greatest scars upon its fabric. Even now, centuries after its end, when few, save ancient and shriveled creatures such as myself, remember the horror of those dark years, men speak of it in awe. For those were the last days of legend, when the Emperor and his sons, the mighty Primarchs, strode forth to war, when the dominion of mankind spread across the galaxy, and none could challenge our might, the last days of the Golden Age, long since consigned to dust by the actions of one man. It is the curse of history that few care to remember, other than those fragments that exalt them, to relive those glory days endlessly while the present crumbles about them. That was a lot of commas for a quote.
It's a lot of Oxford commas.
I was waiting for a period, and it was just comma after comma after comma. I was like, oh, shit. It just keeps going. And that is from the Final Testament of Sulam Rey.
Historia. Some people just like to comma over and over again.
Some people. The Historiarch of the Imperial Court, presented to the High Lords of Terra, circa 098.m32.
So yeah, guys, are you ready? Are you ready to jump into the heresy?
Buckle up.
Any predictions?
Anybody have predictions
as to how it ends?
Wait. Is Horus the bad guy?
I want to say Horus betrays somebody.
Maybe. I've heard people ask, is Horus still
heresy?
No.
Istvan's the bad guy, right?
Yeah, Magnus did nothing wrong. Istvan's the bad guy.
Yeah, it's all Istvan's fault.
The saved. Saved. Wrapped up. If you learned anything from our show, it's that Magnus did nothing wrong and Istvan is the bad guy.
Magnus definitely did nothing wrong. I gotta say, we're not gonna go over this again because we talked about it to no end on the actual episode, but it is true. I don't believe he did anything wrong.
Oh, I'm sure we'll get into the Magnus did nothing wrong argument.
He had to make just a choice. Like,
just like sad violins and thunder warriors are gonna come up over and over and over again. It's fine. It just happens.
Yeah.
Nothing? You're not going to rise to the bait there?
The Horus or Russi?
No.
Is Horus still War Master?
See, there's the old man voice we were looking for.
The Horus Heresy, sometimes referred to as the Age of Darkness, was a galaxy-spanning civil war which engulfed the worlds of humanity for close to 9 Terran years. Its outbreak marked the end of the Emperor of Mankind's Great Crusade, which had aimed to reunite the worlds of humanity into a single interstellar government. With the lasting effects of the Horus Heresy being, in many ways, the foundation of the Imperium of Man as it exists in the universe of Warhammer 40K. The conflict's beginning is hard to pin to a single event, as the machinations of the ruinous powers of chaos can be seen in many events of the later period of the Great Crusade itself. But with the wounding of the War Master Horus Lubrikol, and his resurrection, in many ways, by the ruinous powers, the coming heresy became completely unavoidable. Those same powers and dark gods playing on Horus's ambition and insecurities, twisting the latter into a sense of grand betrayal, until Horus sought to overthrow the Emperor and take the Golden Throne for himself. The charismatic War Master, in turn, swayed half his Primarch brothers and their Space Marine legions to his cause, each which brought with them the influence that they had among the Imperial Army and the ancient Mechanicum. The conflict consumed the galaxy in the early years of the 31st millennium. While the conflict lasted around 9 years, the last 7 saw Horus cut a bloody path directly towards the throne world of Terra. It claimed more than 2.3 trillion human lives, a number adjusted to 4.6 trillion if you include the worlds the Imperium purged after its resolution. It saw the traitorous Horus dead, even as the Emperor himself was mortally wounded and then forever interned into the Golden Throne. The surviving traitors pushed back into the Eye of Terror, and the Imperium of Man set onto the path for its current state.
Would Sanguinius be a part of that 4-point-something trillion?
Dead? Yes. Sanguinius would be included.
Sanguisquidbilius.
That's what I'm going to call it from now on. Sanguilius.
The Sanguilius Valley.
The Sangria.
Sanguilius.
That Primarch Sangria over there and his blood orange angel boys.
Or rednecks in Kentucky. Talk about the Horus Heresy.
The Horus Heresy.
Heresy. I said heresy, my boy.
The heresy is responsible for the birth of the present-day structure of the Adeptus Astartes. Changes that were made by the Ultramarine Primarch Reboot Gilliman as the Lord Commander of the Imperium and the Imperial Regent during the Time of Rebirth, which followed the heresy in the late 31st millennium. Changes which led to the Second Founding and the Space Marine chapters as they exist and we know them in modern 40K. To those Astartes in the modern setting know, even the eldest of Space Marine veterans, these events happened in what effectively is completely ancient history. A history that not only took place over 10,000 years ago, but which has been heavily censured, edited, and propagandized by the Adeptus Ministerium, the Mechanicus, and the Inquisition. We will now talk of times and events which can seem at times contradictory, of ancient villains and heroes whose true deeds, motivations, and more may have been specifically washed from the Imperial record. Like most of the Warhammer 40K setting, while this lore is verified, it may only be part of a greater hidden truth yet to be released or written. During Season 3, we have largely been focused on the early Imperium and its history. And for a full picture, we would recommend that you seek out each of these series, from our Planet Spotlight on Terra itself to our most recent coverage of the Great Crusade. And go ahead and pause. Go listen to all that. Okay, great. Now that you're back.
Now that you've listened to all those episodes in our backlog.
Now that you listened to several hours, probably 20 or so hours.
Yes, it's probably a day at least. Minimum.
And episode 69 is crucial to part of that story.
Which so make is sure not you, part of season 3.
make sure you listen to episode 69 because that is a critical part of the Horus Heresy.
The Horus Heresy.
Yep.
Are we now calling it the heresy?
Yeah, the Horus Heresy. Oh
my God.
It was that episode was very Horus Heresy. Very much.
The Horusy Heresy.
The Horus. Yeah. It's not gonna get
horrible. Heresy was very horrible.
Wow. Oh my God. It's like every time somebody said Lictor and we're like, Lictor, I barely knew her.
What was the other one? There was another one that was besides Lictor. It was Rector. No. It was another one. It was a. I think it was another Tyranid bioform episode. Yeah, I think it was another Tyranid bioform.
It was probably a good joke.
It was a good one. I did. I totally messed it up.
You should memorize all of our episodes, Marky, just in preparation for retelling your own jokes.
Memorize my social security number.
That's why I'm doing this entire refresher. It's just for you. Speaking of, here is that quick refresher, just to set the scene for the events to come. The Age of Terra, a time some 28,000 years before the Horus Heresy, saw humanity migrate away from old Earth and into the stars. Humanity spread to a million worlds, facing enemies and challenges lost to time, while also finding uncountable glittering wonders and dark horrors. Technology had reached an unparalleled height, and the dreams of humans were truly boundless. The application of science could even reshape entire worlds to match old Earth's image. Legends depicted an era of plenty, culture, progress, and general wonder across a galaxy littered with opportunity. However, these achievements led into the Dark Age of Technology, where humanity had achieved godlike status, commanding some amount of stellar power to craft lifelike servants from raw materials, the Men of Iron. This wasn't the only unraveling of science's many utopian promises, though, as the human ambition set Mars and old Earth at each other's throats. And then the Men of Iron turned on their very makers in a cybernetic revolt. Ambition, lust for power, unchecked experimentation, and dark desires saw terrible weapons created and unleashed. Death consumed the empires of humanity in a time now remembered for its horrors and terrible cost. A time plagued by warp anomalies and the influences of darker things. A time that lasted for many Terran millennia.
So, is it safe to say that Terminator is not canon in the 40K universe because history was just doomed to repeat itself? If they would have watched the Terminator movies, they would have known that
Cyberdyne Systems to the historical record.
Exactly, the historical records. It's like Galaxy Quest?
Galaxy Quest, yep. Yeah.
Yeah, the historical records. You gotta watch them. You're just doing the same mistakes. You made a Cyberdyne and you unleashed it, and look what happened. You played yourself.
My favorite DJ Khaled quote ever is there's a little Dicky song where he switches places with Chris Brown. I can't remember the name of the song, but it's called Freaky Friday. So he switches. Little Dicky switches places with Chris Brown, and then they do a rap video, and then they swap back. And at the end, he keeps jumping through different bodies, and he ends up in DJ Khaled's body. And when he arrives in it, he immediately screams, "DJ Khaled!" And then he stops, and he's like, "Why am I always yelling?"
It's the perfect amount of awareness right there.
It's pretty good. And it's DJ Khaled delivering the line. I'm like, I'm glad he has a sense of humor about himself.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But you reminded me of DJ Khaled always yelling, Marky. Thank you.
Me?
Yes.
Always.
I can't remember what you said, but it made me think of DJ Khaled always yelling.
I was talking about Terminator. Maybe it's just because I'm fat. Is that why?
No, that would have been Jabba the Hutt.
No, you yelled something. It's fine. It doesn't matter anymore.
Personal attack on me.
What did we say? Anyway, I don't know how we tangent. It just happens, okay?
We were talking about the Men of Iron, and I talked about Terminator 2, and then you started talking about DJ Khaled, and I was just like, what's going on? What's happening?
It's because you said something. You made me think of it. It's your fault.
Yeah, I don't know how it came up,
but you said something that made me think of that.
Wow.
I think a lot of it is just, to kind of get a little bit towards what you're talking about, is a lot of these science fiction properties deal with the whole idea of our hubris creates, even the Matrix's story, Terminator's story, Isaac Asimov's iRobot, and the original story, obviously the movie, which has very little to do with the original story. All of this stuff kind of centers around the idea that we build robots to take care of us, to do our job for us. And then at a certain point, the robots get sick of our shit and take over.
You remember that literally, movie, right? AI?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen AI, but literally speaking, if there was a robot that wiped your ass.
It might be too boring for Marky, but Ryan probably seen AI.
AI is a pretty good film.
That one's great. AI, it's more about questioning the soul than it is about just artificial intelligence taking over. But at the same time, it's a good one in reference to AI.
I can't remember the name of the movie, but there's a movie where the entire premise is an alien species is invading Earth.
Species?
And then the twist at the end is that the alien species that's invading Earth are humans, and the humans that are defending are robots. They're AI.
What? Oh. That's crazy.
It's a mind trip. I think Michael Peña is in it.
I was going to say, there's an episode of Doctor Who where it turns out one of the bad guys that are invading Earth are actually humans from the future in robot form.
I can't
remember.
I think it was a Netflix movie, Ryan.
It is a Netflix movie.
Yeah, I did watch it.
I think there's several of those, because Cybermen are technically that also. And
Cybermen are the Russians and the Daleks are the Nazis.
Yeah, I could see that.
They're 100% a stand-in for those two. Yep.
It didn't take me very long to see all the conclusions, because even the way Daleks drive around and the way they're portrayed on screen, they always have their gun in the salute pose.
My favorite little bit of making fun of Doctor Who is when, I think it's in Community, they're trying to get away from whatever the fuck they call the Daleks in Community.
Yeah,
They run up a set of stairs.
Yeah, yeah. And it can't fly because it's not a real Dalek.
Yeah. Anyway. Oh, fuck.
Actually, fun fact. There's a lot of debate going back and forth lately in the social medias about who could beat 40K again. It ebbs and flows when those conversations come and go. And it's been funny to watch.
We had that conversation last week.
Did it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, last week I was...
Who can be 40K?
Well, how did I... Did
anybody bring up Time Lords? Because Time Lords definitely can win.
Well, no, you know One Punch Man, Kevin?
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about One Punch Man.
I definitely know One Punch Man. I mean, as a single person, his power is to become as strong as he has to be to win. So he's basically the definition of plot armor.
Yeah, well, I was attributing it to it. Hit One Punch Man is is essentially 40K to all the other like sci-fi titles. Exists.
In a way, right? Yes.
I don't know if I agree that Time Lords could win, and I have one reason. There is an alien. There is an alien species. There is a Xenos alien species. Well, I mean, Time Lords would be perpetuals. But there is an alien Xenos species in 40K that's essentially the Weeping Angels. And we know that the Weeping Angels are capable of wiping out Time Lords.
Right.
So I think
that's like that, the one species that could do it. Yeah.
And the Silent and the Silence too. At that and the Time Lords, I mean, they have one planet.
It's like a Doctor Who.
Do they
Who
only
thing?
Have one planet? Yeah, it's Doctor Who. But yeah, essentially the Doctor Who universe collectively could wipe 40K, I'm pretty sure.
I think the doctors would put up a fight against 40K. I don't think the universe would put up against 40K. Because, I mean, the majority of the universe is like...
The majority of the universe, not so much.
Awkward British people.
The Santarans versus Space Marines, though. That's a pretty fair fight.
I need you to further
the
explain...
The Leagues of Votan versus...
Not to further go through this tangent, but I need you to explain why you think the doctors would put up a fight against beings in 40K. I don't know enough about Doctor Who.
It's pretty good. You should watch it with your family. They'd actually probably
I tried watching
together.
It. I think we had this conversation. I tried watching it, and I stopped after the episode of that chick that had her skin stretched out on like a little tarp.
Moisturize me.
They were spraying
she's
her with
a reoccurring character, and it's hilarious.
Yeah, I was just like, Jesus Christ, I can't.
God.
It starts weird, but Time Lords are incredibly OP, like smart. And they can basically see like what Farseers see, like the infinite possibilities. They see and feel that themselves because they're basically exposed to time, like the time only part of the warp. Put it in 40K
terms.
It's
an entire race that lives on a planet together. That they've got their own planet. So think of like 6 billion people on a planet that are technologically advanced, and each one of them is essentially the Emperor. That's what the Time Lords are. So that's probably the crux of the argument, is that you've got a planet of Emperors. How could the Emperor deal with a planet full of Emperors?
And also the fact that they're willing to go back in time and just undo people before they exist. Like, they'll be like, oh, the orcs are a problem? Great, let me just go back in time and genocide every planet that the orcs will take over eventually. We'll just cease those planets to exist from time, and then the orcs aren't ever a problem.
Yeah, but the Time Lords versus the Tyranids, it's going to end badly.
That one, they don't really have an answer for until they develop just a continuously evolving, like, time prism bioweapon nonsense.
All it takes is the Tyranids eating one Time Lord.
Oh,
and
then the galaxy's
ruined
over. For everybody. Everybody's screwed. Everybody's screwed if the Tyranids eat a Time Lord. Everybody loses.
That's all it takes, man.
Because then you have every Tyranid is suddenly one of those warp gators.
Yeah, right.
And they're popping in everywhere.
I can definitely see why that argument came up. I don't know.
It was the first time I had seen the Doctor Who universe brought up in it, and it gave me an interesting thought. I was like, actually, Daleks, Doctors together with Santarans are pretty strong. All those three together would put up a pretty gnarly fight.
Yeah, but I mean, like, at the same time, Daleks and Cybermen and even Santarans are defeated by, like, modern military equipment.
Santarans aren't. They're bulletproof. Basically to everything, unless you hit them in that one little weak spot. They're like Achilles, basically.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where, like, if a bunch of British army guys can take them down.
I don't think the British army guys ever were able to take down the Santarans. I think that was always the one, like, just like the Cybermen, you just can't kill them, enough of them.
Yeah. All right, well,
moving back to the heresy.
The heresy. So as mankind's first interstellar empire consumed itself, the old night of the Age of Strife truly took hold. Warp storms grew and consumed entire worlds, cutting off and isolating humanity's scattered and far-flung colonies. Even planets as close as old Earth and Mars became completely cut off from one another. For 5,000 years, the loss of central authority, communication, and trade, human worlds descended into chaos, anarchy, and warfare. New empires grew as others were consumed by warp-spawned horrors, psykers, and the ever-spawning warp storms that ravaged entire planets that had existed in peace for centuries. Hundreds of Xenos species sought revenge or plunder for these unprotected worlds, further regressing the survivors into isolation and even barbarism. Cut off and isolated, ancient Terra fell, becoming a radiation-plagued wasteland controlled by warring techno-barbarian tribes and insane warlords, legendary tyrants like the Unspeakable King and the Seven Neverborn, locking the planet into a state of constant warfare. Despair pervaded as humanity seemed doomed, but contrary to belief, hope emerged. The Age of Darkness would not last forever.
As the Emperor came and clapped all their cheeks,
and he said,
"This is my planet."
Yeah, he spread his golden light to everybody.
This Earth-ussy is mine.
Sweet golden baby Earth-ussy. Emperor, blessed be his name, came and brought the truth to Terra.
Speak his name, seven ounce baby emperor.
Golden, beautiful baby emperor.
He came out the womb clad in golden armor.
I'm glad you knew what I was getting at.
Smoking a cigar. I fucking Talladega Nights is like up there. That is a watched yearly movie in this household, sir.
Oh man, I haven't seen it in too long, but one of my favorites is just "I'm going fast." I just say that all the time for dumb reasons.
Chip, don't make me climb over this table and beat your ass. The fucking kids, dude.
Right.
Entire kids fucking movie.
Hilarious. The kids could make their own movie.
Every once in a while, one of us, either myself or my fiance, will say, "If you ain't first, you last." And it never never has any connection to anything that's happened. Like, we'll be weeding in the garden or something.
And you just say it.
"If you ain't first, you last." Like that matters or makes any sense.
It's just completely out of context. I'm sure it's more funny the more out of context it is.
100%. As Marky alluded to, amid this chaos, the Emperor of Mankind emerged with a goal of first reuniting Old Earth and then the galaxy. With his genetically enhanced Thunder Warriors and later the first of the Adaptus Astartes, he overthrew the brutal rulers of each techno-barbarian state, forming the Imperial Army with regiments like the Geno 5-2 Kiliad and the rest of the Old Hundred. And so Terra was born from the ashes of Old Earth in the Unification Wars. The Emperor then extended an alliance to the Cult Mechanicus, granting them autonomy and the resources they would need for the coming Great Crusade. With the Treaty of Mars, this alliance was solidified, becoming the foundation of the Imperium of Man, marking a pivotal moment in history. With the unification of Terra assured and the Imperium of Man founded, the Emperor turned his attentions to the rest of the galaxy. He gathered about him a war council, led by himself and Malkador the Sigilite, and it would be this council that was responsible for governing the Great Crusade, a council formed from not only the warlords and nobility of Terra, but from the aristocratic dynasties of the Mechanicum of Mars and the representatives pulled from the Navigator Houses. In 789.m30, the Emperor himself led the Great Crusade into the stars, leaving Malkador in charge of the Imperium as regent of Terra. But Malkador would not sit idly, instead forming the intelligence branches of the Imperium, which would become the bedrock for the Inquisition, as well as establishing the clads of Imperial Assassins, which would later become the Officio Assassinorum, in effect making Malkador the first Grand Master of Assassins himself.
How badass was this guy?
Malkador was the strongest of the Sigilites and the last of the Sigilites, which are like they're not quite perpetuals, or they weren't quite perpetuals, but they were kind of up there. Malkador was the second most powerful psyker in the entire Imperium.
Okay. So he
more,
fucks.
More
he
powerful fucks. Than Magnus.
Not only does
less
he
powerful
fuck,
than the Emperor.
He pretty much can like solo DP somebody. Put it that way.
He's the John Wick of wizards, as one might say.
John Wick of wizards.
So he's got his physical schlong.
And the
psychic schlong. And the psychic schlong is pretty...
is just as big, if not bigger.
Yeah. And he wasn't just like this crazy psyker and this like normal dude, this normal powerful dude. He was also the guy that... I mean, he's responsible for the Inquisition. He's responsible for the Grey Knights, he's responsible for the Officio Assassinorum, he's responsible for the existence of the Ecclesiarchy.
Is he Malkador, still
alive? No. He's well, we don't believe he's still alive.
Okay.
Officially, unofficially, no. but like he, at a certain point, realized towards the end of the heresy, towards the end of the Siege of Terra, he realized, or towards the beginning of the Siege of Terra itself, I guess, towards the end of the heresy, he realized that religion was one of the only weapons that the Imperium had left that it hadn't played yet. And he started working with some of the figures in the early Ecclesiarchy to essentially create the psychic backlog, if you will, that helped power the Emperor. Because at a certain point, it was the belief of people in the Emperor that gave the Emperor more power. Because all psychic stuff is essentially like a belief feedback loop in a way.
Okay.
So Malkador is just, Malkador is playing 6D chess while everybody else is trying to figure out how to draw with crayons.
Yeah, he's got dudes fair. In the rafters spitting on him.
Yeah. In order to achieve his goals in the Great Crusade, the Emperor created the Primarchs to act as replacements to the perpetual allies he had slowly alienated throughout his rise. These genetically engineered super soldiers were even more powerful than the Adaptus Astartes and the Thunder Warriors he had created in the past, and each was set to take command of one of the 20 Space Marine Legions which would lead the Crusade at his side. However, the Emperor had not created these Primarchs entirely on his own, but with the help of his last perpetual ally, Edra. Fearing how the future war and callous calculations of the Emperor and other considerations would affect them as they faced them growing up, and probably more than a little influenced by the Dark Powers, Edra allowed a rift to be opened within the genetic labs, wishing to free her sons to a better life, but actually allowing the Chaos Gods to scatter the Primarchs still growing in their gestational tubes to the far corners of the galaxy. With the legions of Terran-born Astartes, wow, the Astartes, that's the first time I've done that in a while. Still, however, with the legions of Terran-born Astartes at his back, the Emperor's early crusade began as much as a search and rescue mission as one of unification. With each Primarch reunited with their legion, their ranks would swell, with new Space Marines made from their own genetic code. Each Primarch was specifically made to execute the needs of the Great Crusade, commanding unfailing loyalty from their legions. This decision led to an unintended divide, as many of the Space Marines would eventually revere their Primarchs more than they revered the Emperor himself.
Can't have that.
Well, not the best laid plan. Not the worst laid plan, but not the best laid plan.
Yeah. Well, what we really figured out is that everything was great until somebody messed it up.
Everything was amazing until it wasn't.
Right? Everything was going according to some great plan that somebody had come up with.
It was Mama's fault.
It was Mama's fault, yeah.
Is this like an Adam and Eve kind of thing?
Not really. So Edra essentially wanted to scatter the Primarchs herself. She wanted to place them in places, but because the warp is the warp and because the dark powers are the dark powers,
didn't go
they had essentially they had essentially been trying to do the same thing the entire time. So when the opportunity presented itself, they essentially like beat her up and took over.
So she fucked up.
It was a little bit more like best made plans lead to hell sort of thing.
there's also like speculation that she took a couple of the Primarchs?
Yeah, a lot of that's the newer. So the one, some of the newer speculation is that Edra took one or both of the missing two Primarchs, and that one or both of the missing two Primarchs are actually female. But I think a lot of that is a little bit more wish fulfillment and a little bit less like lore.
Yeah,
so the lore is pretty clear on the fact that whoever they were, they done fucked up and got erased.
Yeah,
I never heard about the female thing outside of our podcast.
Oh no, the people have speculated for a long time.
It's something that's been kicked around for a couple of years now. Essentially, since Edra was introduced, and that another thing that's as we kind of mentioned up top, this is a really really dense portion of 40K history, and it's a lot of it's being written right now, like as we're recording this in 2023, not to date us too badly, but as of 2023, the final of the three books of the end, is it the end and the
end and the death
and the end and the death, thank you, is like being released. So some of this stuff is still being fleshed out. Edra and Astarte herself, the person that the Astartes are named after, were introduced in like 2019. These are relatively recent additions to the lore. It's not that they didn't exist. It's not that lore was retconned. It's that lore was really, really hazily designed with a lot of holes. And then they plugged characters in and started fleshing things out and started like filling in the holes. It'd be a little bit like, for instance, Baldur's Gate or Neverwinter Nights or anything in the D&D like video game world. There's a lot of talk about like Waterdeep and Dragonfall and a bunch of these other cities. And they kind of talk about these other cities, but they kind of just mention their names. They don't ever really go into the politics of those areas. Those areas all have lore, or all have the ability to have lore. And that's kind of what the Horus Heresy has done in the last 10 to 20 years of the Warhammer 40K universe, is that all of these things that just had names that were just like little footnotes are now being expanded upon and explored and designed out. So because of that, we went from the Emperor worked with some genetic scientists to make Astartes to the Emperor worked with a geneticist named Astarte. And that's why the Astartes are named the Astartes. And, you know, and who knows how many of these things were like little footnotes in somebody's sketchbook that are now being released to the public, and how many of them are things that have come out as they've expanded and explored the lore.
It's a good thing their name wasn't like Biggest Dickus or something, you know.
Right.
Or like Big Dick, so that way their name is Biggest Dickus. Oh, yeah. Well, what army do you play? Oh, you know, the Biggest Dickus.
The Biggest Dickus.
Is so it also speculated that the that Russ wiped out another legion?
That's kind of what it's hinted at, if I remember right.
It's hinted at that, yeah, because Russ is kind of called like the big dog who's sent out to destroy things. Although it's also very specifically mentioned in Prospero Burns that the first time an entire Astartes legion fought a legion was the Thousand Sons fighting the Space Wolves. So it's really weird that there's like this rumor that Russ is sent out to destroy Space Marine legions.
I don't think he was sent to kill the legions. I think it was kill the Primarchs.
He was sent to kill the Primarch. Yeah.
And then they just didn't, they just didn't make those legions, you know. They're like, yeah, and shut production down. We'll just roll some of those into the other legions. Yeah,
they just become Grace Shields and they get rolled into the other legions. Is exactly what happens. And Grace Shields being a term that 30K used to describe Marines that hadn't been assigned yet.
Like just Terran born before everything went down.
And specifically 30K. When we get into 31K, Gray Shields and Black Shields mean something completely different. And then in 40K, Gray Shields and Black Shields mean something. They're just blanket terms that get used a lot. But one of the reasons that the original two lost Primarchs existed was so players, like in third edition and fourth edition, so players could make their own chapters. They could make their own legions. Now we don't necessarily have that because now we've got all the different foundings and essentially like the chapter system is detailed out and explained, and the Codex Astartes exists as a book that you used to be able to buy. I don't think it's in print anymore. So you can actually look through what Roboot Gilliman said, like it's definite, defined lore. And because of that, you don't have to rely on this whole like, oh, well, you know, my chapter or my legion is from one of the lost Primarchs. I also kind of think at this point they're holding them. They'll do something with them at some point, you know.
Maybe
it'll be like this, the squats coming back as the League of Votan. They'll pull it out when they need it.
That could happen. You know what they'll probably do, since there's two of them, it'll be, I mean, just knowing that it'll probably end up being their female and that one's Chaos and one's Loyalist, you know, or yeah, something I can like see that. Like that'll be like, or, they're like, we need something.
Yeah. Or they'll do something completely nutso and crazy with it.
Absolutely.
And it'll literally be one of them is Sigmar. And that's the reason that they're gone, because Sigmar got banished to the old world.
Right. That would be dope lore if that's how it worked.
Oh my God. What if one of them is Sigmar and the other one is Bellicor?
There we go. Tinfoil hat award of the night.
Yeah, no shit, right?
That I don't think we're gonna beat that conspiracy ever for at least another episode.
The other thing that could happen, there are a lot of hints in the most recent Dan Abnett Inquisition book series that only two of the books have been released for it at this point, and the third one is coming out soon, that we are going to find out that the King in Yellow is a specific person. Like there's there's a lot of evidence that suggests that it's one specific person, but knowing Dan Abnett and knowing Warhammer 40K, I would not be surprised if they were like, ha ha, fucking fooled you guys. It's one of the Primarchs that you thought was lost, or one of the Primarchs we all thought was dead, or literally there's another Chaos God. Like, they could do anything with it at any point. And that's kind of the way that 40K is written. 40K is written so that they can pull the rug out from under us at any given moment.
Oh, one of the best plot twists is, I mean, spoilers alert if you haven't read Gaunt's Ghosts, but when he's literally writing from the point of view of the Inquisitor that's possessing the dude. You remember what I'm talking about?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And it's entirely led you up to believe that it's Rain the whole time, or Ron, or whatever, however you want to pronounce his name. And then it just goes all the way up to the point where he's like, and then this guy points his gun at so-and-so, and you're like, mind blown. Like,
you're like, wait a minute, what just happened?
What?
Did they just Emmalite M. Shyamalan, M. Yeah, Night Shyamalan exactly. Me?
Yeah, he Shyamalan-ed you. Shalama Lama knighted you.
That's what'll happen. They'll be like,
oh, and man, and it was so well written, because he had kept it that like the gig was kept up for like what, two chapters, three chapters, maybe
and
more.
The way that that's always got to be done too, and Abnett's definitely capable of doing it, is that when the like twist reveal happens, you don't have to go, oh, this guy's fucking with me and making something up. It has to be like, oh shit, all the clues were there the entire time.
I think there wasn't even clues, and I think that's what made that one genius, is the fact that there was an absence of clues, but you didn't ever catch
it. But it made sense.
Yeah. Yeah,
but it made sense.
As soon as it clicks, you're like, I was too invested in it being a character to notice that it wasn't that character. Because I knew the plot twist was coming when I reread it recently, and I looked for hints, and I was like, oh, he was good.
But I've got, I don't want to get too deep into it and spoil, but if you haven't read the Beckwin series, which is the third Inquisition series that Abnett is writing now, go and read them. They're really good. I've had like three, I have three theories on who I think the King in Yellow is. And one of what the reason that I have different theories, and the reason that I don't think it's the obvious answer, is because I'm very familiar with the concept, the literary concept of the King in Yellow, as being something that's like
a thing
that's existed since the 1800s. So I just have this feeling that I have a feeling it's going to literally be a King in Yellow. It's going to be like a force. I would be happy if it's who everybody thinks it is, because I think it could be pulled off right, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's just literally like this unspeakable force that nobody can understand. But anyway. Like
Holy Trinity type stuff.
Yeah, so the King in Yellow is a play that essentially drives the people who read it crazy. Is kind of the best way to quickly sum it up. Like, it's a thought concept that drives people nuts. And like, not like I'm going to make weird music for the rest of my life and name my child after a string of characters crazy. Like, I'm going to peel your face off and eat your soul with a straw crazy. Have you ever seen True Detective, the first season?
No.
You should watch it, one, because it's a fantastic fucking horror series. But the main antagonist is the King in Yellow, or the concept of the King in Yellow. Anyway, we should do when we get around to doing Chalk and I are going to talk about the old gods, the Lovecraftian gods at some point. When we talk about that, we should dip into talking about doing a creative writing episode where we specifically talk about like existential dread and the roots of existential dread as a writing series and all that. It'd be fun.
Favorite part about 40K, the existential dread.
That's right. All of the existential dread. There are a lot of important conflicts that took place during the Great Crusade, with the latter years blending into the early events of what would become known as the Horus Heresy. Basically, the Horus Heresy is kind of looked at as being usually referred to as being about 7 years long, and that's because it was 9 years long, but those first 2 years were kind of the last 2 years of the Great Crusade. Probably one of the pivotal events, and one that is also often seen as a linchpin to the heresy, is the triumph at Ulanor. One of the biggest triumphs the Imperium had against the Orcs, and a battle which saw Horus named Warmaster by the Imperium. An act which allowed the Emperor to return to Terra so he could begin his next major project in furthering humanity's development. If you want more details into all of this lead up, check out our last few series, our last series exactly, which gets a lot more detailed into the conflict, the triumph at Ulanor. History isn't pretty or well organized, and the events of the Crusade and the Heresy reflect this, with many blending into one another, especially in this like last little period. While we might tread on some ground we've walked in detail before, from here on out, we are going to look at all of the events that we've already looked at, but we're going to look at it from an angle of exploring how it led to the start of the heresy proper.
Well, I would say it's, what's her name? Edwin?
Edwin.
Is that her name? Edwin?
Erda.
Erda.
Or Edra.
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 Yeah. It's her fault.
Right? Magnus did nothing wrong. It's all Edra's fault.
Oop, you gotta go back.
No. It's Istvan's fault. We already decided that it was the man named Istvan. He did it all.
Wait. Is that the name of the missing? That's got to be it. The missing Primarch that Edra stole. Primarch's name is Istvan. Nailed it. I figured it out. We don't even need. There we go. Perfect. Skip the rest of the episode. And
we have fixed 40K. So anyway, in our next series, under the
balls Death of Star madness. Of
madness.
Under the rug in the living room.
Under the 11th room. We're going to focus specifically on the stormtroopers that worked in the concession stand on decks 99 through 103 and how shitty it was
that they died in a terrorist attack.
I have to piss off Patrick every episode with one thing.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't provided any health care or life insurance for their families. It was a bad situation.
Right?
You know, sometimes you get little snippets of information and you really want to share them with everybody because you want to see what type of Googling mistakes happen. And then you're like, nah, I'm not going to do that. So because of that, I'm absolutely not going to share the false information that the Emperor and Reboot Gilliman had 34 rules which dictated the start of the heresy. And then if you want to know more, you can type in the Emperor and Gilliman Rule 34 to read them all.
No.
Did someone write that? Or did you riff that?
No. That's something that I read. I'm not evil enough to riff that in the middle of a script.
That's terrible.
Was it Mullins? Who was it?
It was Mullins.
It doesn't even matter who it is. Like,
no, I know exactly who it is.
50-50, I leave that in the final episode.
50 Shades of Magnus over here.
Well, it's got to stay in now. Oh,
my God. Yeah, not with the 50 Shades of Magnus joke. It's staying in. All right, so Seeds of the Heresy. Horus had been the first of the Primarchs to be reunited with the Emperor, and in the earlier years of the Great Crusade, a conflict which raged for 200 years, he had been the only one to have been reunited. This meant that the Emperor and Horus fought side by side alone for many years and experienced that none of the other Primarchs would ever have with the Emperor. Not only did this lead to a deeper loyalty between the two of them, but it also meant that Horus was the Primarch the Emperor actually treated and identified the most as being a son. While the triumphant Olinor and the naming of Horus as War Master, the Emperor stopped leading the fight from the front, returning to Terra to work on the Golden Throne and the Human Webway Project. This meant that Horus was in charge of leading the other Primarchs. Men who had been created to each be great leaders on their own, only seeing themselves as subservient to the Emperor. The announcement of Horus as War Master was met with shock and outrage. The other Primarchs did not understand why the Emperor was leaving them to fight humanity's enemies alone, and while some, like Rogel, Dorne, Sanguinius, and Fulgrim, were pleased with their brother as the new War Master, others, such as Angron, Reboot Gilliman, Lionel Johnson, and Perturabo, were displeased with the turn of events to varying degrees of aggravation. The situation grew even worse when the Emperor announced that he would create a civilian administrative bureaucracy, the Council of Terra, which would carry out the Imperium day-to-day governmental duties. This organization was to be made up of Imperial nobles and bureaucrats, while the Primarchs would be regulated to the position of the Imperium's preeminent military commanders. Many of the Primarchs, including Horus, were deeply troubled that their father would make them subject to mortal men and women, and worse, those who had never even understood the matters of honor or the battlefield. Something the Emperor had done on purpose, though, as he once again wanted humanity to govern itself and not become beholden to a ruling caste of genetic super soldiers. It was these resentments that became the first sparks of rebellion that the Chaos Gods would leverage and blow upon to become a giant fire.
Sounds like it's going swimmingly.
It's yeah. Always going swimmingly.
All
everything
planned, comrade.
As long as plan has no wheels.
As long as plan is more like boulder falling downhill as long as it's on the cart. Yes, exactly. That was planned from start. All is intended.
All is planned.
All is planned. Always planned.
I have a
plane crash with people. Totally planned.
one of the foremen I work with at work has a heavy Russian accent.
Well, very good.
Ooh, which is fun.
Just reminds me of you guys.
Can you record it? Can you have him come on the podcast so we can have him say stuff?
his name is. I can't say his name, but
the machine.
I am the machine.
That movie, by the way, was fucking hysterical.
His accent makes me happy. I love the guy.
Oh yeah, I think my favorite conversation with an Eastern Bloc coworker that I had. his name was Victor, of course. You know, stereotypical. But I made the joke. I was like, I had to like hit something to make it work again. And I was like, just like back home, right? And he goes, dude, you have no idea.
I'm surprised you weren't like, what does he say? American or Russian components, American components, all made in Taiwan or whatever.
All made in Taiwan.
Fucking, what is that? Armageddon?
Why
does Armageddon come up in this fucking podcast often?
Because it's actually.
It's a pretty
well encompassing story.
Same reason. This is the same reason Species always comes up in this podcast.
No, that's just you.
Did you guys see that there is a petition to restore the original ending to Deep Blue Sea where the doctor doesn't get eaten by a shark?
Wait, what?
Which doctor?
So the girl doctor. You know how at the end of Deep Blue Sea it's only LL Cool J and
the chick?
Thomas, the Jane that are left alive?
Yeah.
Yeah. So remember the doctor throws herself in the water to like distract the shark and You think that she's going to survive and all that, and then she gets
wrecked. Yeah,
she gets fucking eaten. So there's a petition.
Wrecked.
There's a petition to change that.
Why?
To make it the original ending, which is happy. And I'm like, no. The ending of Duped Lucy is perfect. Okay,
what?
Everybody fucking gets eaten. Yeah, I know, right?
What in the snowflake ass bullshit is this?
It's a perfect. Apparently, this has been a thing since 99.
Wow.
Like, it's the original deleted scene ending, and there are a bunch of like hardcore Deep Blue Sea fans that want it restored. And as Samuel, a hardcore Deep Blue Sea fan, I'm like, no, the movie's perfect. Leave it alone.
It's great, yeah. And I'm assuming that Samuel L. Jackson getting eaten by a shark is racist, too.
The only thing that could make Deep Blue Sea better is if LL Cool J and Thomas Jane also get eaten by the end of the movie.
That'd be amazing. Right when they thought they were going to make it and the helicopter comes in, it's actually not dead and it just fucking wrecks them too.
Jason Statham goes running across the screen and the Meg just fucking swallows them both.
I was over here hoping for John Cena.
Oh my God, dude. All right. So Olenora was seen as a turning point.
His name is John Cena.
So the reason that Olenora was seen as a turning point was it was the last great conflict that separated the galaxy not firmly being in the hands of humanity from a time when humanity had reasserted itself and become the predominant force again. So essentially, before Olenor, the orcs were a massive problem and the humans having control of the entire galaxy was in question. After Olenor, they were like, well, we defeated the biggest concentrated Xenos threat. We're in charge again, boys. Because of that, with the Primarchs under Horus, now bent to the task of cleaning up the last details, that's why the Emperor headed back and he called to his side Malkador the Sigilite and Fabricator General Kalbor Hall of the Martian Mechanicum. No longer would they support the ongoing military campaigns. Malkador, the Emperor's most trusted advisor, was named the First Lord of the Council, as well as Regent of Terra, and he would lead in the Emperor's absence. This meant that Horus, as War Master, was the head of the Council of War, and Malkador would sit opposite him as the head of the Council of Terra. Fabricator General Kalbor Hall, Captain General Constantine Valdor of the Legio Custodes, and the then current masters of the Adaptus Astronomicon, Adaptus Astra Telepathica, and the newly formed Administratum would also serve positions as High Lords on the Council of Terra. With this, the Emperor locked himself away to begin that next big project. The Primarchs and a growing number of their Astartes warriors felt that since they had bled and suffered in the creation of the Imperium, it should be they who ruled it, which lent weight to Horus's later arguments with several of his brothers that they had been betrayed and as soon as the war was over would probably be replaced. Horus convinced himself and then his followers, the petty functionaries and administrators that had supplanted them as Primarchs and Astartes. The glory of the Imperium was over. Now the red tape of parasitic executors, scribes, and bean counters would demand to know the cost of everything. How long would it be before the Primarchs and the Astartes were cast aside, just like the last tool set the Emperor had used? Already bureaucrats were replacing the heroes of their age, and the greatness of the Imperium was becoming yet a footnote lost in some dusty history book. They had all of these fears while the crusade was still happening. They were like, we are being regulated to the dustbin of history before the war is over.
So
it's
Mullins brings up a good point. How well do you think the Great Crusade would have handled the Tyranid threat in 30K? I feel like we would just have 30K instead of 30K and 40K. It would have just stuck. There wouldn't have been a heresy. It would have just been
the heresy wouldn't have happened. Yeah, I think that's the big thing. I think we would
consolidate the Space Marines to stay as one.
I think we would still have the same number of Primarchs left. I think we would still have the same number of Legions left. I think that 9 would have been completely destroyed.
Oh yeah, they would have sacrificed
Chaos,
Instead of them falling into chaos. Yeah.
We probably have like, I feel like we'd just have chaos space marines in that case. Like we would just have, the emperor would be sitting on the throne because like some gnarly swarm lord would have mortally wounded him just like Horus did.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have a bunch of dead, completely loyal Primarchs, and then we'd have a bunch of chaos space marines that are essentially just normal space marines, but influenced by the chaos gods.
Yeah, I think we'd have a little bit more like renegade chapters rather than legions.
Yeah.
It interesting thought experiment. I think
100%.
And that's even if chaos even got a chance. I mean, honestly, this was chaos's big move. So if the Tyranids had showed up as chaos was pulling their big move, I don't know if chaos would have been able to deal with it, because chaos has a hard enough time dealing with the Tyranids too.
That's true.
Well, I feel like their influence wouldn't have been to turn the space marines against one another. Their influence would have been use them as a tool for survival and power against the Tyranids. Yeah.
It interesting. If the Tyranids showed up at the Battle of Ulanor, shit would have gone way differently.
Yeah, definitely interesting thought experiment.
Yeah. I don't think we've seen, I mean, everything we've seen with the four tyrannic wars has been each time there's a new tyrannic war, there are just more Tyranids coming in from the outside of the galaxy.
And less space marines.
Yeah. So I don't think it's really one of those, like, it would have paused. I mean, maybe it would. I mean, maybe the war against the Tyranids would be in its 10,000th year.
Right. Now. Yeah, I agree.
It was this fear, hubris, and arrogance that acted to leverage Horus ever closer to his fall to the ruinous powers. But it was also never what the Emperor had intended. The Primarchs and the Astartes were meant to be protectors of the Imperium. These great beings, however, already had a very tenuous grasp of humanity and had been created specifically for war. They had never been intended to become humanity's new tyrants, which is what they would have become. Essentially, if the Primarchs and the Astartes had been intended by the Emperor to become the rulers of the galaxy, we would have gotten 40K and 30K. It would have happened a lot faster. And this was a concept that not all of the Primarchs nor Horus were ready to accept. They didn't like this idea that the Emperor was pretty clear with them. Like, no, you guys have a role. Your role is to be the military. Your role is to exist as our protectors. Your role is the role that you were created for. But men need to govern men. You can't, have Astartes warriors governing men. And the funny thing is the reality, the galaxy that does get shaped
is the opposite of that.
That does happen. It is Astartes often who are given entire governorships of worlds and stuff. And sometimes that makes sense. Like, obviously you kind of need that crazier mind to deal with like five different star systems.
Yeah.
But in a lot of cases, the Astartes that are being put in that position also aren't the ones that are kind of fucking twacked. They're not the tyrants. They're the ones that are like very dedicated to their, as much as nobody in the 40K universe is a good guy, a lot of the Astartes who have been named like system governors or deal with bureaucratic things are the ones who are incredibly level-headed and capable of not murdering everybody in the room.
I mean, Space Marines are just Primarchs on a smaller scale, right? And Gilliman, when he first came, didn't he spend like 2 or 3 weeks locked up in a room just trying to figure out the politics of like current events and whatnot?
Oh yeah. Yeah. When we get into the era and Dominus and what's going on, I mean, so Gilliman launched an entire, this actually came up in our Discord chat in this last week. Gilliman launched an entire inquiry to figure out what fucking year it was. There is a, there is a war in the Inquisition called the Chronostrife, which is literally groups of the Inquisition arguing as to whether or not it is the end of the 41st or the beginning of the 42nd millennium or the beginning of the 43rd millennia, because so much of history was just ill recorded and fucked up and not calculated right and not tabulated. And Gilliman has pretty much settled on the fact that we are in the first like 200 years of the 42nd millennia. So the answer to that question, which happened on the Discord, is that technically 10th edition 40K takes place 200 to 300 years into the 42nd millennia. It is no longer the 41st.
Interesting. Hence why you have kids of once well-renowned characters and whatnot. I mean, obviously the tabletop's a whole different thing, but like you have a full grown ass woman from Creed's
daughter showing up.
Yeah.
Yarik dying of supposedly old age, yet all the Catachan heroes still here.
That's really Harker's weird.
Still kicking.
All the Catachan heroes are still alive.
Did you just spell Ghazghul Thraka? OLD space AGE? I would never spell Ghazghul Thraka that way.
He didn't.
Yarik's skull's on his fucking belt.
It's not, though.
No, it's on Angron. I'm sorry. It's on Angron's belt. I fucked that up.
Yeah.
I'm going to go into the shame. I'm going to go into the lore shame corner.
You better. I was like, what are you talking about? The whole point is that Gaz is going to crusade against whoever did it.
Because Ankron killed him. Right.
Yeah, that was his Humi.
Oh, fuck, man. Shame, you're Ryan, like,
man,
shame.
Now I'm the worst. I should just quit.
I can't even leave this podcast anymore. I guess it's time
go
to start.
Go home, Ryan. You're drunk.
Under the banana slug of madness. Go home, Ryan. You're drunk. All right. The long road of corruption. Long before the tragic events that would take place on Istvan III, which truly kicked off what we call the Horus Heresy, Lorgar, I always do that, and the Word Bearers had already committed themselves to the ruinous powers. Lorgar, a fervent religious man, had visions of the Emperor as a living god who was on his way to reunite with his son, which led to him starting a religious war on his homeworld of Kolis to establish the Emperor's worship. When the Emperor arrived, Kolis was already under Logar's cult sway, and the people hailed the Emperor as the God Emperor, celebrating him for months, after which Lorgar was made master of the 18th Legion Imperial Heralds, which he renamed the Word Bearers. The Emperor had not begun the Great Crusade to reshackle humanity with the chains of superstition and ignorance, and he was greatly disapproving of this. Wishing to return to the Great Crusade and dismissing this organized religion as it was a violation of his imperial truth. However, Corferon, Logar's adoptive father and chief religious advisor, survived the augmentations and the process to join the Word Bearers as a rare adult space marine. We talked about these quasi-space marines, although he would never be a true Astartes. And he became Logar's chief advisor in the Legion, as well as the commander of the 18th Legion's first company. The progress of the Word Bearers in the Crusade was slow, and they sought out and burned any blasphemy and heresy in the worlds that they took, burning icons and religious texts that didn't see the Emperor as a god. They also spent time preaching the Emperor's name and building giant monuments to him and the Imperium. It was during this early time that Logar wrote the Laetitia Divinitas. Laetitia Divinitas? Is that what we decided, Kev?
Which one?
The Laetitia Divinitas? Divinitatis? Laetitia Divinitatis.
Yeah, that I think is about right.
Yeah, there's an extra A in there.
Yeah.
Which laid out the case of the Emperor's divinity and ironically became the instrument and the foundation of the Imperial cult and later the Ecclesiarchy. So basically, it kind of read a little bit weird there. It reads better as a sentence than it reads as a out loud, but Carpheron kept this position. So even though the Emperor was like
and it was
dismissive of all of this stuff,
he survived and it was rare.
Right. And exactly. And it kind of gave more credence to him. And because of all of this stuff, the fact that the Emperor was very dismissive about the like religious fervor was immediately like kind of counteracted because Carpheron survived.
Right. And if he had died, then probably would have just either gotten swept under the rug or they would have turned him into a martyr. So it was a lose either way.
Yeah, it would have definitely been an interesting that's another one of those like alternate histories of 40K that would be interesting to talk about. Like if Carpheron didn't survive, it would have just been Erebus.
Right. All by himself.
On his lonesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And would have Erebus had enough pull to do some of the stuff that happens?
Because you kind of like need a second man. Like you need a backup man to back you up when you start talking nonsense.
Right. It's definitely It's definitely one of those interesting thought experiments. For over a century, the word bearers had waged war in this way, leaving some of the most loyal imperial worlds in their wake. And not once had the emperor admonished them, but the emperor was greatly disturbed by Logar and his legions' unwillingness to submit to the imperial truth. And eventually it became too much. The Ultramarines were brought to bear alongside Malkador, the emperor, and some of his personal bodyguard. And the center of the word bearers took place at Monarchia, the capital city of the world of Kerr. This is when the Emperor psionically dominated the entire legion, including their Primarch Logar, and forced them to kneel as the city was razed around them. Logar felt extremely betrayed and refused an audience with any but Corferon after this. After speaking with Logar, Corferon convinced him to also call Erebus, the legion's first chaplain, to his side, and both the Astartes sympathized greater with their Primarch. Feeling that the Wordbearer's Legion should serve gods that were truly worth their worship, Corferon and Erebus explained that such gods did exist in the old divine beings that had once been worshipped by the old faith of Colchis, for they had both been devotees of these old gods for decades. So basically, Corferon and Erebus never embraced the Emperor as god. They had always kept this old faith just in secret, even from Logar. This is how Logar learned of the Chaos Gods, beings that would not only accept worship, but would demand it. Intrigued by these new gods, Logar demanded that the word bearers find them, and Corferon, along with Erebus, proposed a pilgrimage. These were the first true seeds of the Horus heresy, sown among the word bearers some 40 years before the heresy would begin in earnest. So you've got, essentially, Erebus and Corferon as active traitors, well, as hidden traitors for about 80 years before the heresy starts.
Hold up. The emperor doesn't mind if you have a religion, right? As long as you kneel to him, he didn't care what you believed in, right?
Incorrect.
To a certain degree.
The ecclesiarchy in modern 40K doesn't care what your religion is, as long as
you call it
it's
the
close enough to the God Emperor. However, the Emperor himself believed in something called the Imperial Truth, which was the embrace of secular reasoning and science. It, essentially, in the Imperium, during the Great Crusade, religion was outlawed, period.
Maybe I'm thinking the Tao.
You weren't necessarily censured or like punished by anybody except the word bearers, but it was heavily discouraged. But the takeaway, essentially, the takeaway from Logar and the word bearers is that for essentially 80 years before any part of the Horus heresy happened, these dudes were already traitors.
Traitors from day one.
I mean, they wanted to listen to the emperor. They just wanted someone to.
They were old gods. That's what we just talked about.
Yeah. Not Corferon and Erebus. Corferon and Erebus never. They were part of Logar's cult because it gave them power. They were never true believers of the God Emperor. They had always continued to believe in the existence of the old gods.
Right, but they followed the Emperor's rule, right?
Yes.
And they weren't
the Emperor's rule.
And they weren't the first ones to betray the Emperor, right?
Erebus and if you had to pick two people who first betrayed the Imperium, the first true traitors, it would be Corferon and Erebus.
Well, I mean, just because they're believing in someone or something that are the old gods doesn't necessarily mean that they're betraying the emperor.
It's the chaos gods, though.
They were,
but they didn't know that it was chaos. They just know that they're gods.
Corferon and Erebus knew what the dark powers were. They were essentially laying the seeds for all of this shit 40 years before the heresy happened. They were already pulling the strings and manipulating Logar and the word bearers down this path.
Okay. I mean, I'm not trying to play a devil's advocate here. It's more of just
you're
like
asking good questions. I got you.
Yeah.
Cause it's one of those things. Like, are you, Is it like a negligent crime or is it an active crime? Is essentially what you're sort of asking.
Exactly. Like, where is the line drawn where it's like, okay, now you're a traitor just because you.
About 80 years before the heresy started.
When they started.
That would be where the line was, essentially. That's kind of when Erebus and Corpheron start pulling strings a little bit here and there. Mm-hmm. Or at least actively admit to themselves and to some of the word bearers that they're traitors.
Well, because that's what I'm trying to say is, like, where is the line of where you're a traitor? Just because you start believing in the old gods, that's what makes you a traitor?
No, when they started actively trying to manipulate the future of the word bearers and the future of Logar away from the Imperium.
Now, away in what, to what degree? Like, away, like, hey, we need something to believe in, so we're going to believe in these old powers, but we're still going to listen to what the Emperor tells us?
That's the way that they play it. That's the front-facing thing. We'll actually talk about that here in a second, is that essentially they play act that they're listening to the Emperor.
Mm.
But the truth is they're already about 40 years. And I guess that's the answer to you. About 40 years before the heresy starts in earnest, Logar makes the decision that he's going to go find who these dark gods are and swear himself to them in opposition to the Emperor. He is going to willingly embrace becoming a traitor.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And if he didn't, if he was just like, I'm going to go see what these dark gods are about, then you could kind of plead the ignorance route.
Right.
And that's kind of where Magnus, you know,
right.
If you want to make that argument, that's kind of where Magnus is. Magnus knows that there's this weird dark shit out there and he wants to catalog it and make sure that he understands it so it can't be used against him. As to where Logar is openly embracing it at a certain point.
Yeah.
I do like the Logar did nothing wrong stance though, Marky. I'm going to get that printed on some t-shirts.
With a question mark at the end of it.
They're not
going to
be popular. They're not going to be popular at all.
Well...
So Logar rejoined the Great Crusade, but only as it served as a front for the Word Bearer's pursuit of the Pilgrimage of Logar. He specifically journeyed to the fringes of Imperial space with the Legion's Serrated Sun chapter as part of the 1301st Expeditionary Fleet, accompanied by 5 members of the Legio Custodes who were tasked with keeping the Legion from sliding back into their old habits. Their pursuit of what Logar began to refer to as the primordial truth, or for a place where gods and mortals could truly intermingle, led the 301st to the Cadian system, near the largest permanent warp storm in the galaxy, the Eye of Terror, mm-hmm. which had consumed the heart of the old Eldari Empire. At first, the Legion's astropaths advised Logar that voices whispered from the vicinity of the warp rift, but soon enough, as they got closer, the voices began to speak directly to Logar. It was Cadia that would cement Logar's understanding that religion was not some construct of the human mind and collective unconscious, but a universal truth that all former religions were an expression of worship to the one true power of the universe, chaos. This so-called primordial truth of the existence of chaos changed Logar and his legion forever, as they became more and more exposed to the ruinous powers. They became the first of the Space Marine legions to worship the chaos gods, and the first traitors that held contempt for the Emperor in their hearts. The word bearers and Logar would spend the remaining years of the Great Crusade, again about 40 years, attempting to enlighten humanity to the truth of the spiritual nature of creation.
Okay, fair enough.
So that, I guess that's your ultimate answer, is they made the decision.
Yeah, I think once you make that conscious decision, then yes. Now, meanwhile, while this is happening, no other legion is
This is a long time. So the
Before Magnus,
before Horus is wounded, before the Interrex. This is about 20 years after Davin, the planet that Horus is wounded on, is first taken.
Yeah.
So the warrior lodges exist, and we'll get into that in a little bit here in a second, but the warrior lodges are how Erebus and Carpheron and Logar start to like kind of leverage and bring Marines to them. But at this point, is 40 years or so ahead of time, it's all really subtle. It's subtle corruption. It's whispered promises. It's hints at power. None of it is overt. However, as the word bearers take planets now, when they're not being watched by the Legio Custodes, they're specifically trying to enlighten the new populations of these planets to the truth of the Dark Gods. They're essentially already starting to create little tiny planets and fiefdoms of traitors. They're building, in essence, the first couple of like stable blocks that Horus will be able to use when everything kicks off as like launching points.
So these are like all the pawns on the chessboard moving up, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, sowing the seeds, if you will.
Okay.
Ultimately, they would resort to manipulation and deception to corrupt 9 of the Primarchs, including the War Master Horus, targeting the Primarchs and legions that the Chaos Gods demanded them to, even as they corrupted those worlds that they took. When it became clear that all of humanity would not be enlightened to the truth of the ruinous powers, at least while they were still shackled to the Emperor's false imperial truth, Logar resolved to pay a great price in the blood of others, eventually willingly helping to orchestrate the Battle of Istvan 3 and the Dropsite Massacre of Istvan 5, as well as helping to plan the bloody path Horus's forces would carve toward the homeworld of humanity. When Horus openly declared his rebellion against the Emperor, the Word Bearers were the first and loudest legion to support his cause. They were even ready faster than some of the sons of Horus. For they had fallen first, and well before the waning years of the Great Crusade. But first they had to lay the groundworks, priming the galaxy to burn between the rage of the War Master and the seemingly unstoppable progress of the Emperor's Great Crusade.
Well, it got stopped. Just a little bit.
Yep.
Just a little bit.
It's that really, really bad rock and hard place. That hot rock and hard place. Not only is it a rock and a hard place, but it's on fire. Yo,
all right.
I got to send an email this week where I just said shit's on fire, yo. And it was a work email.
Yeah. The best.
I send those every week.
And everybody knew exactly what I meant. I didn't have to describe. The fall of Horus. So we're going to jump back here for a minute. After Horus had taken command as War Master, the Primarchs truly revealed themselves to be far from perfect specimens of humanity that they had been said to be. For all their godlike power, they were vain, egotistical, jealous, arrogant, power-hungry, and insecure, showing all the flaws known of in the human character. This caused division among them, with only Logar, who we mentioned was already scheming, and a handful of other Primarchs standing by Horus's side in these early years after Ulanor. And to be clear, not all of the Primarchs who stood by Horus's side in the early days were scheming like Logar. It was just Logar. The others, you know, Rogel Dorn was one of the ones. Sanguinius was one of the ones. They supported Horus. On top of that, Horus believed that he had somehow failed his father, who hadn't even shared with him his true plans and what they were back on Terra. These caused seeds of frustration, bitterness, and resentment to grow within them, possibly most of all inside Horus. So Horus basically, you know, he has this big history with the Emperor, and he kind of feels that he's owed truth. He feels that he's owed an explanation, more so than anybody else. And the Emperor is like, I'm not even telling you. I'm sorry, it's too important. I can't even let you know. And it's not so much that it's like, it's too important, I can't even tell you. It's more like, I don't have time, I need to leave. It's
too
like
complicated.
Not now, kid. You know, are we there yet? Shut up, kid. It's kind of that reaction. Yeah, it's too complicated. You wouldn't understand it. However, it was on the moon of the world of Davin where Corpheron and Erebus's machination sealed Horus's fate. 60 years earlier, the Luna Wolves, Horus's own legion, had brought the world and its habitable moon into compliance, adopting at that time the native Davinites' institutions of the Warrior Lodge. What seemed like simple fraternities, the secretive nature of these Warrior Lodges would allow Logar a tool he needed to begin to manipulate Horus toward the service of the Chaos Gods. And this is kind of what we got to when we talked about the Warrior Lodges before, Marky. It's a good idea on paper, but in reality, because it's secretive and because it exists outside of military command structure, it essentially allows Logar, Erebus, and Corpheron to start implanting all of these ideas and gathering allies, finding people who may not follow the ruinous powers yet, but agree that the emperor isn't doing the right things. They're essentially finding people who agree with them that the Imperium is being run incorrectly. And that's like that step in the door. That's that like, all right, cool. Now we're past the door. Now read our pamphlet on the Dark Gods. We jumped back 60 years to talk about where the Warrior Lodges came from. Coming back to where we were, there was a battle on the moon against the undead chaos spawn of Nurgle. And this was Davin's moon. So Davin and its moon were both habitable. To get back to the battle on the moon of Davin, this was done against the undead chaos spawn of Nurgle. And during this battle, Horus was wounded by the planetary governor Eugen Temba, who was using a chaos-tainted and poisoned Xenos blade, which had been given to Temba by Erebus. And this blade had also been dedicated to the power of Nurgle. Although Horus and the Luna Wolves were ultimately victorious, Horus was left with a tainted and ever-bleeding wound, which proved impossible for Imperial science to heal. Working through the Warrior Lodges, the dying Horus was kidnapped away from the apothecaries of the Vengeful Spirit and taken to the Temple of the Serpent Lodge, a place where the Davinites and the Word Bearers promised Horus could be saved. So that's kind of that danger of the Warrior Lodges. The Warrior Lodges in this time are able to act. And as we kind of talked about in our Great Crusade episode, where we talked about this from the other side, there were people in the room as Horus was dying under the apothecary that were like, it's over, let him die. Like, our science can't save him. We're not giving him over to sorcery.
Yeah, that's it.
This is just what happens.
This is what happens in war. Yeah.
Right. And the Warrior Lodges played their hands, kidnapped his body, and took him down to the planet surface.
Dirty, dirty lodges.
During the dark ritual, which transpired inside the confines of the lodge, Horus's spirit was transferred into the Immaterium, where he bore witness to nightmarish visions of the future. Seeing the Imperium of Man as a regressive, violent theocracy, where the Emperor and many of the Primarchs were worshipped as gods. Notably, however, Horus himself was absent in these visions. Visions that were ironically the truth, which the War Master's own actions would assure got brought about, but presented as a true conclusion to the Emperor's current plans. Plans which would shackle the galaxy to ever to his worship, something that Horus knew the Emperor stood against and believed the Emperor stood against and didn't understand why the Emperor would actually be lying and leading him to this. But again, all of these resentments and all of this kind of arrogance and just not looking at the full picture had been playing on Horus's mind through Logar, Erebus, and Corferon now for a couple of years. So he was ready to believe the easy lie rather than the hard truth. The dark gods betrayed themselves as victims to the Emperor's psychic might, claiming that they had no interest in the affairs of mortals and the material realm. They claimed that what they showed was one, but one of many possible futures, and the future which only Horus could prevent. Visions that Horus, already jealous and resentful of the Emperor's seemingly sudden secrecy, was eager to accept as fact. In return for their help, the Chaos Gods' pact was simple. Give us the Emperor, and we will give you the galaxy. Horus accepted, and they healed his grievous wounds and filled him with power of the warp. He renounced the Emperor and led his legion, now renamed the Sons of Horus, slowly down the path to worshiping all Chaos Gods in the form of Chaos Undivided. Magnus the Red, Primarch of the Thousand Suns Legion, had foreseen all of this, having traveled himself to the warp to attempt to plead with Horus to reject the ruinous powers in their pact. Having failed in this task, and already using sorcery that had been forbidden by the Emperor's decree, Magnus felt he had no choice but to force a psychic warning to the Emperor, a warning which penetrated the potent and layered psychic defenses of the Imperial Palace on Terra, kicking off the last domino which needed to fall to assure the coming storm. And that's where we will wrap up with our first episode on the Horus Heresy. As a lot of 30K's events all blend into each other, we focused on recapping a lot of the important points in this episode to essentially lay everything out. Check out our three-part series on the Great Crusade if you want more details on a lot of the stuff that we kind of covered a little bit in brief. We will return next week with more detailed information on the Istvan massacres and then get into the actual opening years of the conflict itself. So just like we kind of looked at everything from the different side today of the stuff we talked about towards the end of the Great Crusade with Davin and Horus, we will look at the true scale and scope of what happened on Istvan and why it really kind of essentially, when we talk about the two massacres on Istvan and we get the two massacres that happened in the Istvan system, I should say, the Istvan 3 atrocity and the drop site massacre, we will specifically lay out or get everything laid out to talk about how the galaxy splits, which forces go with which side, and how everything becomes kind of unified before this like 7-year plunge towards Terra starts. And if you guys are looking for ways to get into contact with us about any of our episodes, you can reach out to us through email at either underthehiveofmadness@gmail.com or jimdarkgaming@gmail.com.
Also, feel free to join our community on Discord. We should have all the links and whatnot below or in the description. Not only can you talk to us about lore, hobby, tactics of Warhammer 40K, but you can also get involved in other topics like Age of Sigmar, Magic the Gathering, role-playing games, video games, and a lot more. You can also find us on Facebook, interesting, Instagram, and Ryan is on TikTok. I am definitely not on TikTok. Or find us at www.underthehiveofmadness.com. Spelling and links in the show notes, like I said earlier.
You can also help the podcast grow by liking and reviewing us wherever you get your podcast fix. We are on Spotify, Apple, Google, Audible, and many more. Another way to support us is through Patreon at www.patreon.com/underthehiveofmadness. All Patreon members get access to video podcasts with minimal editing, so you can see our beautiful faces and hear all of our amazing blunders and side conversations. All Patreon levels also get access to our quarterly painting contests. Plus, we have perks at higher levels, such as giveaways. So go on over and check all of that stuff out. Misfit Alley, your center for all things nutty and debaucherous. Come on down and check out their never-ending carnival of mischief. Splitting the edge of reason, we are the manifested maniacs of the pirate Vox Wave 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Reminding all of you Chemrats, hive mice, and some ghoulies to keep those dials fixed. Right here, same ratty frequency for a dose of the same ratty-ass attitude.
Whence the abyss meets the stars, the formed emperor brawls. Fain marriage of cosmic dread and earthly vermin, heralding the eternal winter of Innsmouth's soul.
That's some creepy shit. Y'all should read a book. Creepy.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Good night. Thank you very much. We will talk to you at some point in the future.
Yeah. Catch you next week.